but I mean,
we're living ahead of the time that it actually is.
Exactly, very ahead of time. Thank you.
You sing?
I only see it something in the future.
Is there some song, some short, easy song that you like to sing? Just some gay little song that you remember.
My fellow Americans.
Say goodbye.
Tune in for a shortcut through 1994.
It was a nightmare.
No, 94 was, yeah, it was a good sort of...
A horrifying nightmare.
Not 11 p.m. New Year's Eve, right here on WBAI-FM.
All right, we're here. Let us never speak of a shortcut again.
Just think how much you're going to be missed. You don't have Nixon to kick around.
Oh, Power Rangers!
Talk about your entertainment.
And it's just about 10 o'clock. You're listening to WBAI in New York. Once again, it's time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. Couldn't get much worse.
And a very good evening to everybody as we come together once again for another edition of Off the Hook, the exciting program that takes you full speed ahead onto the information superhighway and making no stops along the way, I might point out. It's been another fun week, another week full of activity and changes in the world of technology and telephones and the internet and things like that. We'll be taking your phone calls at 212-279-3400. Yeah, this is the week the Pentium people finally gave in, and they basically said, yeah, okay, all right, shut up already, we'll give you what you want. You want a new chip, we'll give you a new chip, just stop embarrassing us so much. It's what we call, and this is a new phrase we're going to coin right here tonight, it's called the Netcom Syndrome, okay? And we're going to explain what that means in a little while, but basically Intel had a good dose of Netcom Syndrome, and they're trying to get out of it now. They're trying to get out of it. They took out a full-page ad. Check out page B8 of today's New York Times. To owners of Pentium processor-based computers and the PC community, we give up. Leave us alone. Well, okay, in their words, though, they said, we at Intel wish to sincerely apologize for our handling of the recently publicized Pentium processor flaw. The Intel inside symbol means that your computer has a microprocessor second to none in quality and performance. Thousands of Intel employees work very hard to ensure that this is true, but no microprocessor is ever perfect. But you didn't know that. No microprocessor is ever perfect, particularly Intel microprocessors. What Intel continues to believe is technically an extremely minor problem has taken on a life of its own, not unlike a computer virus. That's right. Although Intel firmly stands behind the quality of the current version of the Pentium processor, we recognize that many users have concerns. We want to resolve these concerns. Intel will exchange the current version of the Pentium processor for an updated version in which this floating-point divide flaw is corrected for any owner who requests it free of charge any time during the life of their computer. And then they give an 800 number, which I'm going to call right now just to see what you get if you reach this number. 1-800-628-8686. Let's see who answers.
Intel customer service and technical support is currently closed.
Oh.
We are sorry to have missed your call. Please call back during normal business hours, Monday through Friday.
Well, let's see if we can hack their voicemail.
Calling Intel Corporation.
No, they're not. Nothing. I'm getting nothing here. Not there. They're not hackable. So, forget that. You won't get through. All right. We're not going to be able to solve our Pentium problems tonight, I'm afraid. But that's what's happening in the world of Pentium. Oh, how nice. I don't know if anybody out there has taken up on this offer or intends to. I'd like to hear from you if you are planning on doing so. I don't know how they will know. Anytime during the life of the computer, that means 25 years from now, if you decide to send in your old Pentium chip, they'll have to honor it and replace it. Not quite sure how they plan on doing that. Or how they know if you're sending a new chip back. You know, it could go on forever. Okay. We have some other things that are going on as well, including something that I think is a bit startling. Some information about let's see, where should we begin here? How about this? You're walking through an office. This comes from PC Week. Some outrageous and not so outrageous predictions. PC Audio's next push into the world of corporate computing will be dealt a major blow when a disgruntled layoff victim at General Motors destroys hundreds of hours of work by running through a floor of cubicles yelling, "File, close, no." Now, by doing this, of course, that's activating certain voice commands, voice recognition on certain computers, and that will obliterate unsaved work on speech-enabled systems. It'll close the files without saving. File, close, no. That little gem comes to us from John Markoff, PC Week magazine piece entitled Oral Hacking. Yeah, okay. What else has been going on? Well, we have, okay, we mentioned NetCom before, and of course there is an ongoing problem on the net with NetCom, as many users may realize. We've talked about this in the last couple of weeks concerning various Usenet postings and mail bombings and things like that, you know, the internet kind, not the explosion kind. And a lot of this... this material seems to be coming from a computer system known as NetCom. They're a very big system. They have dial-ups in almost every city. They have something close to 35,000 users, which is a phenomenal number. And basically, what has happened over the past few weeks is that people have gotten access to NetCom accounts and been able to write all kinds of interesting programs that will post thousands, if not more, messages to Usenet news groups and mail them to all kinds of interesting places. We talked about last week, Computer Emergency Response Team was the recipient of many of those messages. And, it definitely caused quite a bit of conversation. And in fact, we refer to this as spamming on the net, when something is sent to many, many different places repeatedly, something like what Cantor and Siegel, the two famous lawyers, did when they sent out their mass mailing to thousands of computers on the net. What happens sometimes is when someone does that, it elicits all kinds of responses, and so the effect is kind of the same, where you keep quoting the message that you're talking about, and it gets all the more out of hand. So something that sends out 1,000 copies elicits 750 responses, where they quote the 1,000 copies that went out in the first place, and then you have another 500 people responding to the 750 that responded, and everybody's quoting the message, and it gets everywhere. It's incredible. The next thing you know, it's in Time magazine. Well, what happened in this particular case was that time after time, different accounts from NetCom were apparently being used. And unlike a lot of other systems that we've come to know and love, systems like The Well out in California, systems like Escape and Echo here in New York, that when they have a security problem, they do something about it, they talk about it, they communicate, let people know what's going on. We got no such reply from NetCom. We tried. We sent mail. We asked them to post something on the net. Nothing. They would say occasionally the problem has been dealt with, but then the problem started all over again with another account. Meanwhile, in the hacker community, it's fairly common knowledge that NetCom has security. what's the opposite of second to none? I don't know. Next to last or something like that. Or if not last itself. And so a lot of people got kind of angry. In fact, I got angry, all right? I got angry and I did something that some people didn't think was a good idea, but I kind of thought needed to be done. And I kind of like to know if people agree with me on this. And in fact, Fiber Optic is here. Welcome.
Hi.
How you doing?
Okay.
You know about all this, what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. What I did was I managed to go out there and get everybody's username on Netcom, every single one of them. There's 35,000 usernames on Netcom. I don't know if they really have 35,000 users, but there's 35,000 names out there. And what I did was I distributed that list, and I sent it to certain people, and I said, look, if you want to contact these people, since Netcom apparently has no interest in sending mail to its users or posting something on its login banner saying, hey, we have a problem, let's do something about it, change your password, people are getting in, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Since they're not doing it, someone has to. So here are the people to contact, 35,000 names. At the time, I don't know, I don't think I really could think of anything better to do since there didn't seem to be any other way to reach these people. You know, sending out that many names, I guess, can be considered kind of spamming in itself. But it was only something like 250K of names, which is a lot of names. But when you consider that up to 500 megs of mail has been sent back and forth to various places, that's really not that much. I don't know. As a system administrator, what do you think of that?
As far as that kind of with email.
Well, overloading people with email is obviously not very cool. But as far as using that as a sort of a net response to a problem. The users take it into their own hands. They send mail to the users, say, hey, by the way, you're on a system that is not secure. I mean, do you think that's responsible? Do you think that's something
definitely. To net? In fact, there was an incident a couple of years ago for the company that I work at. Mm-hmm. Another popular company in the New York City area had a problem with packet sniffing, which we've talked about in recent shows. And people were using that other service to connect to ours sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So not only was the person logging into the first service being compromised, but them using their account on our service, and hence unauthorized people gaining access to our service, was also occurring. And, I mean, we really had a coordinated effort. I mean, it wasn't anything major or massive. It was just a simple task of changing the login banner to say, here's what happened. And for further news and to keep yourself updated, check this item in this conference.
Mm-hmm.
on the service that I work at, Echo. So people were really kept abreast of the situation as it happened, as it unfolded. And the first company in question that the people were first logging in through to get to us, I mean, they weren't really secretive about it or anything like that. I mean, they were very cooperative. And eventually the problem went away. And I mean, it was a coordinated effort, but on the other hand, it was very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's not so much that you have to worry about being able to reach 35,000 people. It's if those people are actively using their accounts that they're paying for on a place like, say, Netcom,
mm-hmm.
all it takes is a simple thing, is like putting up a message in the login banner and the message of the day.
Exactly.
So they see it when they log in, change your password.
And I might point out that was another option that some of us had, that we could actually access the login banner and change
it.
Really? But of course, that probably wouldn't last too long, and it could lead to a whole bunch of unfortunate questions being asked of certain people.
Yeah.
So yeah, this seemed like the legal way to do it.
The other thing that you could commonly do as a system administrator is force everyone to change their password simply by declaring in the appropriate system files that everyone's password is now expired.
Right.
So upon them logging in, they would pick a new one,
mm-hmm.
provided that they know the old one. Of course, that's not exactly fail-safe, because you're counting on the fact that the person that's going to be logging in is who they say they are.
Right, but
so obviously the wrong person can choose a new password as well.
Yes, that is true.
But then it would be a matter of the person eventually logging in and their password not working.
Mm-hmm.
So they would contact Netcom or whoever it may be and say, something's wrong with my account. So, I mean, while there's no real fail-safe way to do it, there are things that you can do as opposed to doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. And every one of those actions requires a bit of, embarrassment for the company, because they're admitting that they're vulnerable. But, you know, this is the Internet. Everybody is vulnerable, and that's the first thing we have to understand. If you actually think that you can run a system that's a fortress and not have anybody get in, you're just, you know, you're waiting for your appointment with doom. People are actually going to cheer when you fall, because that kind of, obstinance is unrealistic. It really is. especially with a big company like that with so many users. Obviously, they have problems. They need to admit it. They need to get some help, some professional help. hopefully they will see this as a good-natured way of sort of prodding them into place, and hopefully preventing the kind of thing that has been occurring, you know, courtesy of them throughout the net. All right, again, we'll be open to suggestion on that. I just want to read something from an announcement that they put out on, I believe this was the December 8th this went out. Now, this was well before all the problems started, and this is referring to something within NetCom. On Saturday, December 3rd, NetCom obtained evidence to indicate that a former user had, quote, guessed, unquote, the passwords to a, just sitting around one day guessing words, to approximately 1,100 NetCom customer accounts. That is no small matter. The majority of these passwords were accurate, so all account. I don't know what they mean by that. The majority of these passwords were accurate. If they guessed them, I would imagine they would be accurate. So all accounts involved were suspended pending an arrangement with our support department to change their password. The vast majority of these passwords were easily guessable through standard dictionary methods. I find it hard to believe they actually used a system that would allow a dictionary to guess the passwords. We have no reason to believe that NetCom's own security was violated in this incident, especially given the nature of the passwords guessed. How do you interpret that sentence? What does that mean? They just admitted 1,100 passwords were guessed, yet there's no reason to indicate that that security was compromised. Well, translate that for me, please.
I think from what I understand of the problem,
mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of places don't really care so much about the dictionary guessing method because a lot of places simply have shadowed password files and aren't readable by an average user, so it doesn't matter because they need root to have access to it, and they wouldn't have root in the first place
mm-hmm.
unless they found it through some other means, and if they found it through some other means, they wouldn't need accounts. They could just make as many as they want to. Or they can change someone else's password, or whatever they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if there's 35,000 people on this on the system, and you add one more, no one's going to notice. But mm-hmm. the from what I could tell, anyway, from what I was reading, is it was possible that NetCom was using, since they have so many machines at NetCom, and they like sharing files, like, say, the password file, mm-hmm. amongst the numerous machines at their site, they're using something known as Yellow Pages, or has since the name has been changed to Network Information Services, or NIS, or now NIS Plus, which is supposed to be secure, which is basically something that originated at Sun Microsystems for Sun Workstations, and now for lots of other machines, too, that allows someone to share important database files, like the password file, and the group access file, and so on and so forth. Now, if that isn't set up properly, you can have all the password shadowing in the world. Someone can simply use a Yellow Pages command and mm-hmm. list out the password file.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might have been happening to a certain extent, or it was also possible from what I read, whether it was originally like this or somebody did this on purpose, that the password file was available in the clear at certain times of the day. And if people are familiar with the way Yellow Pages works, basically, the Yellow Pages server pushes out the actual database files to the various different sites that share the same database, such as the password file,
mm-hmm.
at various times of the day when the file is changed. Say, all the people that change their password throughout the day, there's like, it's similar to polling, only it's the reverse of polling. They push it. The actual server pushes it out to all the sites that are considered slaves of the YP server, so that the password file would be updated on all the machines in their domain, since all the machines are used by all the subscribers. So instead of having a copy of the exact same password file a dozen times over, you just have one, and all the machines share it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main purpose of Yellow Pages. Obviously, if it's not set up right, there are going to be problems.
Well, continuing with what they said, and this is also kind of an interesting statement here, which we have to sort of like do a Radio Moscow thing and read into what they're really trying to say. This is also an isolated incident and not related to any other password or server problems that have occurred over the past week, Nor do we have any indication that this incident is related to the alleged break-in recently, quote, reported, unquote, in 2600 magazine. Now, what's this with the quotes around the reported? I mean, we reported it, so obviously, you know, I don't know why it has quotes around it, but apparently they don't believe what we said. What we said was that there are indications that the entire credit file had been compromised, and the indications were that a good chunk of it was posted on the Internet Relay Chat and various other places, too. And just based on the reaction of certain people, it looked like that had happened, that someone had actually gotten access to the credit card numbers of people that had been paying for Netcom access. For one thing, I don't understand why a system would have that online in the first place.
Yeah, that's really ridiculous. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever to keep your entire subscriber base's personal information and credit card numbers online.
Mm-hmm.
There's simply no reason to do that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it might have been just the new subscribers or something. Is that possible? You know, people that applied for accounts in the last 24 hours?
I mean, that's possible, but I mean, even so, why would it be accessible to the outside?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to be. It could just be sent somewhere that's not reachable.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was part of the notice that appeared on some Netcom news groups, netcom.general. This did not appear in the login banner. I think it should have. But this appeared in early December, and it's gone now. That's the interesting thing. After all of this, nobody can find that particular message. And one person who posted on Alt-2600 said the following. He said, "It would seem to me that Netcom's shadow password file has been compromised. Rumors were that it was located in /VAR/YP/Netcom. That's what he thinks the path is. As an adjunct file that was world-readable once an hour like clockwork."
Right, this is the Yellow Pages problem, yeah. I was talking about.
Once an hour, like clockwork, everybody would be able to read it for a few minutes, and the protection mode was changed back. So if that's the case, figuring that there's a 10% hit rate, that's about 3,500 accounts cracked right there. So I don't know. Can basically interpret that however you wish. A couple other things. We have a list here. 500, a totally different subject here, 500 area code is something that will be instituted next year. That's the first step of personal communication services, where you have one phone number that follows you around everywhere. And what that will do is enable you to use a cellular phone, a beeper, I suppose, everything, you know, and you wouldn't have to, no matter where you moved in the country, you could keep the same phone number. Now, what we have here is a list of all different exchanges that apparently are being allocated. Now, AT&T has had the 346, 367, 677, and I understand the 288 exchange allocated to them. All these other exchanges being allocated to different companies. For instance, United Telephone Company of Missouri has the 320 exchange. Central Telephone of Virginia has 882. I don't understand why they're doing this. This seems to be this kind of thing they were moving away from with 800 portability, where an exchange does not belong to one particular company. And with this 500 business, now it looks like they're going right back to that. It also prevents people from getting numbers of their choice. So we'll just have to see where that winds up taking us. What do you think, Fiber? Anything interesting in there?
Well, like you say, it's kind of ironic that after all the trouble they went through, after with the advent of Signaling System 7 and the 800 service database that basically makes it possible for you to have any 800 number you want to and choose the carrier of your choice,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of peculiar that they would revert back to a method where they're assigning exchanges to specific companies. I mean, I don't know that it would be something permanent. I we could only hope that they're going to switch to 500 portability at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they don't have the systems in place to handle it right now, so that to do it as quickly as possible, they're simply assigning exchanges and maybe it'll change. But it's hard to say for certain.
Take a look at the 464 exchange. See if you can find that. It's midway down the second column. That exchange is Edward A. Smith. Owns that. Now, I don't know who Edward A. Smith is. All these other ones are telephone companies, but 464 belongs to Edward A. Smith. What is going on here?
That's weird.
Is some rich eccentric guy out there buying up exchanges? Well, that's a name to watch out for in the future, folks. Edward A. Smith. Don't know who he is, but we intend to find out. Okay, a couple other things. Call waiting and caller ID. Supposedly, that's going to be a reality fairly soon, maybe in the next year or so. I know we mentioned this a couple of years ago, actually. We got some sort of a Bell memorandum about that. And what's your recollection on it? I don't have it in front of
me. The recollection on it was the original drafting in the Bell Court Technical Advisory made it sound completely unfeasible because in order for the data to be sent over a call waiting, you would actually be disconnected from your party. Basically, by disconnected, I mean you wouldn't be able to hear each other, and you'd be muted from each other.
For how long?
For a duration of a few seconds, as the caller ID info was sent.
Do you remember how many
ID
seconds
lines.
About that?
Specifically, I forget, but there was all kinds of handshaking that was being done with actual touch tones.
Right.
And after all that was done, then it sent the data. So it might have been something on the order of maybe 4 or 5 or even 6 seconds.
Yeah, now that's a long time
yeah.
to you know, to be cut off from anybody. And to give you an example. Now imagine being on the phone for that amount of time in the middle of an urgent phone conversation when some other joker comes in and you get call waiting and you have to sit through silence for that amount of time.
Or someone's calling you repeatedly.
Yeah, you know. So anyway, here's what we have on it right now. The new service is called CIDCW, Caller ID on Call Waiting by Bellcor. It needs a new telephone set that responds to a new call waiting tone. Instead of the usual beep to indicate call waiting, you get a special dual tone around 2650 and 2820 hertz. Well, if we had our trusty demon dialer with us, we could produce that tone. But we'll try to produce that for future weeks, so you'll know what that tone sounds like. The new telephone recognizes the special tone and mutes the talking and listening paths in the telephone set. Your talking doesn't mess up the caller ID transmission, and you don't get blasted in the ear with data. After the telephone has muted, it sends a tone back to the central office saying it's okay to send caller ID, and the tone that the telephone sends to the central office is a DTMF-A.
All right.
So they'll be using that fourth row of touch tones, the A key, from the fourth column. That way people won't send it accidentally from a regular telephone set. Ah, but hackers
now,
like us will send it on purpose.
All someone has to do is send this this distinctive ringing call waiting tone initially and then send an A and send whatever they want to.
This ought to be interesting. The return of silver boxing. This person is a contributor to... what news group is this? This is Telecom Digest. He says, I haven't seen any telephone sets that can do CIDCW yet, but I suspect Northern Telecom has a capability in one of their Vista telephones, Beltronics. But no central offices have been announced yet. And I understand this is another contributor here. If your phone replies with a DTMF-D, that means it is caller ID, call waiting compatible. If it replies with DTMF-A, then it is both CIDCW and ADSI compatible. What is ADSI? That is, you know, it doesn't say what ADSI is. Do you have any idea what that might be?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Nope, there's no indication as to what that means. All right, we'll find out that too, but that's something coming in the next year. And here's something someone posted on Telecom Digest, which a lot of our listeners have had questions about, namely the differences between a DMS-100 and a number 5 ESS. And I can sense people just shivering in anticipation here as we go over some of these differences. Some things that this particular subscriber finds, some things he noticed since he got cut over to a DMS-100. Any line that is not POTS, not plain old telephone service, can flash and get stuttered dial tone. What this does is it parks the first connection and will ring you back if you hang up. So in other words, if you're on the phone, you just hit flash, you hear a stuttered dial tone, you hang up, and it rings back. 5ESS, apparently, you cannot do that. Does that make sense?
I don't know if this is true or not. I don't know anyone that doesn't have a POTS line in their home.
I don't know what they mean by that. I think what this person meant was any line that is POTS.
I would say not.
Why?
If you're just plain old telephone service and you're on a DMS-100 and you flash the switch hook, either nothing will happen or you'll hang the person up.
Now, you see, I think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying that any line will give you a stutter dial tone no matter what the features are.
Which, no, what he's saying is that if it's a non-POTS line,
right,
and you flash the switch hook,
uh-huh,
you'll get a stutter dial tone as if you were on IntelliDial or Centrix.
Uh-huh. Okay, if there are no features provisioned onto that line that use the flash function, then dialing anything gets reorder. Okay, I found this because my first line has call forwarding and return call on it, but not three-way calling. So I think he means any line can get a stutter dial tone. I'm not sure. Those of you with DMS 100,
if he's saying that, it's simply not true.
Uh-huh.
He would have to mean you don't get a stutter dial tone if you've flashed the switch hook.
On a DMS 100?
No.
You're sure about this?
Absolutely.
Okay.
There would be people all over the city completely confused as to why they're getting a stuttering dial tone when they hang up.
Well, only if they flash. Only if they flash the receiver.
Yeah, but people flash all the time just,
mm-hmm,
you know, just to hang up. Sometimes they're hanging up and they're about to make another call, so they flash.
Well, you know, I've had several people ask me, why does the phone sometimes ring when I hang up?
Yeah.
I think they might be flashing and then hanging up.
Yeah, if you have three-way, sometimes you're not really paying attention, but people with three-way might flash the switch hook.
Right.
And then hang up, and you're actually putting the person on hold, which is a feature of three-way.
Okay, again, if you have a DMS 100, you might want to experiment with that. You can do it now because all phone lines are tied up, so you won't get through to
us. I guarantee you it will not work.
Okay. It does. Well, I mean, we have some phones in a DMS, but they're on IntelliDial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but the thing is, when you flash and hang up there, you wind up transferring, so it's kind of hard for us to experiment with that particular feature.
But on IntelliDial, you'd get a dial tone anyway when you flash.
Yeah, so it's really not a good experiment there. Number two, the speed dial killer. When dialing a feature code before a call, like call forwarding or cancel call waiting, you must pause for the stutter dial tone to stop after the code before dialing the number. On the 1ESS I was on, I could send 72 pound and then the phone number as one string. On the DMS 100, I must send 72 pound pause, then the number.
That means absolutely nothing. It's completely dependent on the revision. I have a 5ESS in the neighborhood that I live in.
Mm-hmm.
And if I dial *67 and a number right after that, I can't dial it in a constant string. I have to pause.
Uh-huh.
So we're talking about, like, nuts and bolts kind of things that really are completely independent of what switch you're on.
I've noticed that *67 tends to make you pause for a while. And the other ones, like call waiting... I don't know. I saw on a 5ESS, we could just dial it as one string, and then on a DMS-100, you have to pause. It could just be, you know, settings on one particular switch.
Either that or just a software revision. I mean,
mm-hmm,
it's all DMSs and 5ESSs are not created equal. There's various different generic software versions that are floating around.
Mm-hmm. Don't they tend to be the same, though, in the same area?
They can be drastically different, no. I mean, in the particular neighborhood that I lived in, for a long time, obviously, you're well aware of the fact, we didn't have Signaling System 7. We couldn't do a caller ID or a call return or repeat call or any of those features, simply because we were on generic number 3. We were on a 5ESS switch in my neighborhood, but we were on generic 3.1, which is ancient.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, most of the rest of Queens and Brooklyn and elsewhere were already on generics 5 and above.
Now, how do we find out what generic version we're on without actually accessing the switch and
unfortunately, it's not really possible.
They're not liable to tell you that. In fact, they probably won't even know what ESS means when you call them.
Usually not.
Yeah. I mean, let's try it. Let's try it right now. See if the operator can tell us what kind of a switch we're on. Now, I happen to know that we are on a... actually, I'm not sure if I know. We're on a 5ESS here?
Where are we? What office?
Right. I don't even know.
Oh, what do you get when you do 9901?
Well, that's what we're going to try right now. Okay. We're going to try, let's get a dial tone. Okay. 279-01. This should tell us what kind of a switch we're on.
Unless it's analog.
We're not analog. We cut over. Sometimes it never answers at all, too.
Reach the verification number at West 36th Street, DS1, 5ESS, area code 212.
Okay. It's a 5ESS.
Yeah, that's what we are. Okay, so now let's see if the operator can tell us that. Okay, that's... You don't think the operator's going to be able to tell us for a moment, do you?
Not.
Okay, let's see if we can get her to understand anything that we're saying. Because people are curious. They want to know these things.
9 Exercise, may I help you?
Yes, hi, operator. I was wondering if you could tell me what kind of a switch I'm on.
No, I don't.
I'm sorry?
I have no way of telling you what kind of switch. What do you mean by what kind of switch you're on?
The kind of switching system, whether it's a DMS-100, number 5 ESS, or what revision of it that generic is running.
No, we have no information on that, sir.
You're the operator, though, right?
Yes.
You don't know that?
No, we weren't told that. Which we are on.
Do you have any idea how I could find that out?
Let me give you to the repair department. Hold on,
please. Okay, thank you.
Now, there are people there that know.
When in doubt, go to repair. All right, let's see if repair will tell us.
9X repair, Mr. Edwards speaking. Can I have the error code and phone number you're reporting?
Well, actually, I'm just trying to find out what switch I am on. I'm in the 279 exchange in the 212 area code. You able to tell me that?
What switch you're on?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I don't have that information.
Who would I ask to find that out?
Well, what it is, it seems like something that would be over at the central office.
Uh-huh.
I don't have a direct number to over there. What you'd probably have to do is call here during business hours and have a foreman call you back from the central office.
Okay, so if I call repair service...
Right.
Could you transfer us to someone in mechanized loop testing?
No, I don't have a connection for that either, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
You got a kick out of asking that, didn't you? What would have happened if he did?
If he did, then that person would have known the answer.
Are there people in mechanized loop testing at this hour of the night?
Definitely.
Okay. That's somehow reassuring, even though I don't know what they're doing there. Okay, we have a special guest with us. Walter is here. Hi, Walter.
Hi.
You have some information for us on MetroCard.
Yeah, I accidentally erased one of my MetroCards by...
Accidentally
by rubbing it repeatedly against a high-power permanent magnet, I accidentally erased my MetroCard, and Mr. Red Balaclava gave me one of these envelopes. You could mail your MetroCard in, and they'll try to figure out what's wrong with it. And I got a letter back from MetroCard customer service, and this is some of it. You purchased your MetroCard on April 4th, 1994 for $10 and added value on one occasion. It appears that your card was successfully used as 16 fares were correctly deducted each time you swiped the card at the turnstile. Our thorough examination does not indicate damage or malfunction, but they couldn't do anything for me. They told me that I used it and...
Doesn't
indicate damage or malfunction, and I never got a card back or anything.
So they kept your card?
Yeah, they kept the card.
Well, what are they saying? Are they saying that there was no value to it, or what does
this translate to? I'm actually not sure if there was value on it.
Well, to add up the numbers there. You bought it for $10.
$10. They say I added value once.
They don't tell you how much you added?
No. But it was 16 fares.
Well, 16 times 125, that's 16, that's what... $20?
Yeah, that's another $10.
So, let's say you upgraded it once. Does it sound like you would upgrade it at $10 or $5?
That's a possibility.
Okay, so according to them, you upgraded it once to
$10.
Another $10, and that's $20. So I guess they kept your card because... Yeah.
Well,
no,
they didn't say anything about that. I would have appreciated if they told me that the card had no value.
Mm-hmm. Well,
What I found interesting is that they knew exactly when I bought it and exactly how many times I've used it.
Mm-hmm. And where did that letter come from?
This came from MetroCard Customer Service, Nancy Edwards, the supervisor.
And where are they located?
This is 10 Columbus Circle.
Columbus Circle, they're right there.
Yeah, okay. I think they have a something there that you can... They have the customer service center there. Mm-hmm. You can probably go there and with your MetroCard. And have
a MetroCard Museum must be there, too.
Yeah.
The site of the future MetroCard Museum. Okay, well, that's interesting. The... So if someone has a problem, is there a phone number or anything there that people can call?
Yeah, they have an 800 number for outside New York City, 1-800-METRO-CARD.
Uh-huh.
And within New York, it's 212-638-7622. They also have a fax.
I think that spells MetroCard, if I'm not mistaken. Well, I'm spelling it out now. 638-7622? Yeah, that spells Metro, well, without the RD at the end. So
they also have a fax number if you want to send a fax to them.
Okay,
what's that? 212-246-3421.
Okay. Any other information?
Well, once there's something interesting. I was getting out of the 42nd Street exit, Times Square, and they actually had one of these turnstiles open. Normally, I've seen other turnstiles open before, and they're basically empty. This one turnstile they had open had a small computer inside. It looked like a generic PC, and had some IBM token ring equipment in it. And there was a technician there. I asked him a couple of questions, and he verified the idea that my, you know, what I thought, that there was it was actually connected through a token ring network throughout the city, and that, in fact, he told me that each station has one computer in one of the turnstiles, mm-hmm. That manages all the other turnstiles. So I've been thinking that they probably cache the MetroCard transactions locally in that particular station before sending them out to a central computer somewhere.
As a batch.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that.
How often do you think they get sent out?
Oh, I really don't. I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. But it seems like it would be too difficult for each transaction to go to the computer individually.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that does make sense. It does make sense. Okay, well, that's a little bit more information on that. And, of course, we'll be keeping people updated as we learn more. Mm-hmm. 212-279-3400 is our phone number. Let's go to the phones. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Good evening, sir. Let me hang up the other line here. Far too many questions to go into everything I would like to this evening, but
okay.
Let me ask you this. Where does that list come from with the... Oh, by the way, you know about portability and 500 service?
Uh-huh.
Well, I've talked to so many people about the 500 service now, I'm not sure whether it was somebody at Belcor or elsewhere, but somebody said that after the first two or three years of the 500 service, they will do what they did with the 800 service and introduce portability. That it is, mm-hmm. as Mr. Goldberg, I guess it was, said at one point, you were speculating, that is, yes, it will only be for the initial period, first couple, two or three years, that they will assign them carrier by carrier, which is expected to be, that initial set of assignments expect to be completed by next May.
Okay, were you asking where we got the list?
Yes.
Okay, it's in Telecom Digest, Volume 14, Issue 459.
Hold on, Volume 14, Number 459.
Right.
And the title is Telecom Digest.
Yes, you can read that on the internet. It's Usenet, actually. comp.dcom.telecom is the actual Usenet news group.
Could you give me that one more time?
Yeah, comp, C-O-M-P, dot dcom, D-C-O-M, dot telecom, T-E-L-E-C-O-M. I'm assuming you have net access.
Well, I soon will, but just comp-dcom dot, I mean, comp.dcom dot telecom.
Correct.
At...
No, that's it. That's the name of the news group. You can simply use your news reader and read that particular news group.
A news group. And,
right.
And now, however, at the same time, does Telecom Digest come out in paper form as well?
If it does, I'm not aware of it coming out as such. But it is stored in various places, so you can access a bulletin board somewhere or FTP site and get back issues.
It's stored as electronically on...
Right. I don't know if it's being printed. There's a lot of material that comes out. Like, 100 messages a day sometimes.
Oh, and this was a message that somebody who had the list put on there.
Basically, yeah. That's what it is.
Okay, by the way, they're going to have, how some of us have discussed what you can do with the AT&T Easy Reach now called True Connection service, how you can use it to avoid all calling card surcharges.
That's true.
For a flat, let's call it a flat rate of 25 cents per minute, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekdays, 15 cents per minute other times within roughly 50 states, D.C., Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands.
Right. The only problem is every time you want to call a number, you have to go through this elaborate reprogramming.
Right. Well, with the 500 service, now this is from AT&T only. Remember, there'll only be one carrier among dozens or scores or hundreds,
mm-hmm.
who will be offering the 500 service, whereas they were the only company offering the 700, right?
Right.
Okay. They'll have a feature, five versions of their 500 service for, you'll find this hard to believe, but I have it on very good authority. The cheapest version, which will be... $1 per month, and that will be the total monthly charge for it. At that level, you will not have any four-digit charge reversing pins, and you will not even be able to do forwarding, but you will have your lifetime, or let us call it phone number. The monthly charge is only $1 a month. Now, as the guy at AT&T pointed out to me, number one, it can increase their revenues for call charges, okay? Number two, they have the local Bell and other large phone companies around the country do their billing for them for this, and that's why they don't feel they have to have a minimum of $5, or like the 700 service has been $7 per number per month. The second level, actually the next two, are both at the $3 level. One is called Stay Close. $3 per number per month. They will have four-digit charge reversing pins, besides, of course, the five-digit master pin, same as you have on the 700, mm-hmm. but no forwarding. And that's, let's call it Stay Close 1, though they don't have a 1 with it. Now, Stay Close 2, and that's their term, Stay Close 2, though, as I say, the other one is just Stay Close. It's not Stay Close 1. Okay, Stay Close 2, you will have forwarding, but no charge reversing pins. That also, like plain Stay Close, will be $3 per month. Next step you move up to is called the Traveler. This is $5 per month, and it will give you both the four-digit charge reversing pins.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Yeah.
Are you by any chance Edward A. Smith?
No, I meant to say when you came on was to say this is not Edward A. Smith,
okay.
But could you... Anyway.
All right, I just wanted to know.
All right, thank you. No. Kenny,
you should have your own exchange, I think.
The Traveler gives you the charge reversing pins. It lets you do forwarding, and it has a feature called Place a Call. Place mm-hmm. a Call. And this gets rid of that tedious forwarding and quickly unforwarding, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And here, in fact, I just got the guy gave me the information today. One second. Here is the it's very simple and straightforward, almost exactly like a lot of calling card calls. Let me give you the order that you will do the dialing in. Give me one second here.
Okay, we do have to move on to some more calls. If you could send us a copy of that, that would be great.
Give me your fax number again.
Okay,
there.
You can fax us at area code 516
474-2677. 2677.
And that's the 2600 fax machine. You can, you know, feel free to load it up with all kinds of interesting things.
Right. Long Island, 474-2677.
Yes.
Okay, now here, this is very simple and straightforward, but it just tells you what order it is in. Give me one second. I've got it right. Hold on. As you can see, I may sound like a reasonably competent person, but I've got this powerful new computer, and it's sitting there giving me guilt vibes because I still haven't, so I'm still using paper records. Okay, this is the order. You will dial 0 and then 500
mm-hmm.
and then your own 7-digit True Connections number, because AT&T, their version, their name for it will be True Connection. So you dial your own, starting with 0, because some of them, the 700 service, everything starts with 0. On the 500 service, it's more like regular calls. If it's sent paid, in other words, being charged to the number you're calling from, it'll be 1 plus area code and number.
Mm-hmm.
Or trying to think, no, you cannot make straight calls to foreign countries. Okay. If it is charge reversing PIN or calling card, then it'll be 0 plus, okay? And also, you won't have to, as you probably said in the last few weeks, you will not have to use the 10XXX code.
Right, okay.
Don't have to cross over to an AT&T line or an MCI line. Or
right,
Sprint
it'll
line.
Know by the exchange and eventually by the whole number. All right, listen, thanks for all the information. We're going to move on, okay?
Well, hello?
Thanks for the information.
It's
keep
real
us updated.
Quick, okay? So be 0500 and your own 7-digit number.
Right.
Then you enter your own master PIN number of 5 digits, and then you take choice number 2. Which will be place a call, and you simply dial, you've now put in an authorization number, it amounts to like a calling mm-hmm. card number. You now dial the area code and number you actually want to reach. You'll be able to use pound to make a series of calls, and when you hang up, you don't have to then do any elaborate undoing.
I see. Okay, well, I look forward to the day when we can actually do this. All right, thanks again for the call. Okay, we're going to try and fit in a couple more calls today. Let's first see what happens if we try dialing this a 500 number. I happen to know of one that's supposed to exist, but not quite sure when it's going to be put into service. We'll dial 1-500, and then a number. See what happens. Seems to be pausing for something. Ooh.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please check the number and dial again or call your operator to help you. 132A2.
Okay, and that means what? It's coming from where?
132. It means it's coming from a tandem office nearby Manhattan. Belonging to Ninex.
This time I put a zero in front of it to see if that might make a difference. Probably wind up with the same recording, but I'm not entirely sure. Could even get an operator. Same thing.
We're sorry.
Okay, let's go to another phone call here. That sounds like a blue box.
Gee whiz, yeah.
Who's on the line here? Someone's playing with the blue box in this line, aren't they?
We're sorry.
Okay. Hello, you're on the air.
We're talking about that attention signal for call waiting.
Yeah?
I have a computer thing set up, and this is the 2650 and 2820.
Yeah. That's the noise you're going to hear?
Yeah. It sounds like a clear forward signal, like on some bastardized C5.
That's what it sounds like, something a blue box would do. Let me just make sure we have the right frequency here, because that's horribly harsh.
Yeah, extremely.
Of course, it all depends on how loud it is. In this particular case, it was very loud. Okay, let's see what we have here. Now, you had, what was the frequency you were giving? Yeah, that's what we have here, 2650 and 2820 together. Let's hear that one more time, a little less loud.
Wrong one. That's it.
Wow, that's the noise we're going to get. Okay.
Extremely annoying. Concerning getting information about switches, when I had my service upgraded to caller ID, I just dialed, you know, I live in the Bell Atlantic area, I just dialed the 1-800... 799-9977 business line. And when I got that, you know, upgraded my service, I just asked out of curiosity what the switch was, and they went back there, and sure enough, they said 1AESS, and I did the chunk test, and that's what it was.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Pretty much it.
Okay, yeah, you're having a horrible dropout problem here on this line, so...
What about now?
Oh, much Whoa. Better.
That's Whoa. Why, because I have the computer on, you know...
That's certainly a difference there. Anything else you have to say?
No, it's good to speak with you.
Okay.
All I wanted to let you know was that tone.
Well, thanks for filling us in on that, and now we have something else to look forward to.
Okay.
Take care. I don't know if they should have consulted with the populace before they they decided with that particular frequency. Good evening. You're on the radio.
Yes. I love your show, by the way.
Well, thanks.
I had a quick question for you. One is that a couple of quick questions. One, does the 2600 line address, is there still a place where we can write to get a copy of a subscription?
Yeah, I'll give you the address.
Sure.
It's 2600 P.O. Box 752 in Middle Island, New York, zip code 11953.
Okay. I have some old issues of YIPL,
Yipple.
International Party
Yipple,
Line.
Yeah, the predecessor to Tap Magazine.
Is that still around?
No, that actually stopped publishing in 1983. It's been a while.
Okay, but... are they worth anything? I mean, these are from the 70s. They gave some schematics.
People do sell back issues of that, copies of back issues. I see advertisements for it in 2600 as well. People generally ask like $100 for the whole thing, I think. Maybe
another question quick also. Did you have, when you get souped on a line where it's always ringing like I do when I call WBAI, and then that phone company automatically hangs up on you after... 4 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Are you being charged for that?
No, definitely
okay, so
not.
It just eliminates the line.
Right.
How long ago did they institute that?
When they cut over to the 5ESS, which was about, a year and a half ago, that was just part of the package. I don't know, are 1As capable of
Yeah, I'm fairly certain that they are to time out after a certain amount of time.
I don't think crossbars are.
Black boxes or?
No, it has nothing to do with it.
No, it's basically greed, I think.
No, I mean, it's basically to free up the line, really. I mean, there's a finite number of connections that could be made at any one time. And they just choose to boot people off if the phone is ringing for a really long period of time.
Well, I find it really annoying.
Yeah, it is. And if you complain about it, maybe something will be done, because there are certain exchanges where that does not happen.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks for calling. Now, this line here, it says, there's a little note on here that says this line is feeding back. So there's an unfortunate person here who probably will not get through, but I figured we should just see what it sounds like anyway. Good evening. You're on the radio.
Hi, Emmanuel. Fiber, Walter. It's Jeopardy Jeff.
Oh, I hear what... Okay, this is what they meant. I hear my voice coming through several seconds later.
I hear feedback, too.
Do you hear that? This is kind of a neat effect.
I'll make this quick, then.
Yeah, make it quick.
I've talked to Red Balaclava, who, because of unfortunate instances in Lower Manhattan today, can't phone. The new thing with the MetroCard is they're switching the employee passes. The current one allows pass back. The new one won't, so he's looking to attempt to copy his.
Right.
And you'll get email.
Okay.
Get off this line so we don't drive people crazy.
Yeah, driving me crazy here. Thank you very much for calling. That's kind of a cryptic message there in reverb. Good evening. You're on the radio.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, question. I work for the government.
Okay. Which government would that be?
United States.
Okay, I've heard of it.
And they have a phone system called Autobahn.
The Automatic Voice Network.
Yes.
What do you guys know anything about that?
Is that even still around?
Well, yes, it is. And it's really, 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 really old. But it is still used at military installations.
Yeah, they had an 800 number you could call into it.
Yeah.
And you were able to call back out.
Yeah. Actually, if you ever had the pleasure of visiting the Secret Service at Six World Trade, they're connected to both Autobahn and FTS 2000, which are two government phone systems.
How would they work? How would they make a phone call on that?
On Autobahn, the way that you normally make a call is, obviously, it's kind of pointless without an Autobahn directory, because it's a whole different way, a whole different directory of phone numbers that don't correspond to anything.
Seven-digit, ten-digit?
Oh, no, seven-digit numbers.
So it's like an eight, you dial eight, and then there's like a three-digit prefix for that, whatever that site was that you want to dial into.
A three-digit prefix and then four-digit phone number? Is that what
right,
you're saying?
Four digits are like the local
Uh-huh.
And after which you could signal the priority of the call with A, B, C, and D.
Right, the fourth column of touch. Did you have to use A, B, C, D?
I don't know if you necessarily had to or not.
Uh-huh.
I never actually used it myself. I just know about the operation.
I doubt they would let you do that over there. What about the other phone system?
FTS 2000, I don't know too much about. That's a newer phone system that was being set up by Sprint for the government.
And AT&T, wasn't it?
I don't remember what the final word was on it. They were kind of like, kind of battling each other for the contract.
Uh-huh.
But it's obviously newer than the Autobahn network.
What are the? I mean, how do they decide what phone network to use for what calls?
Only certain things are reachable on certain telephone networks. It's my understanding that Autobahn is mainly having to do with the military, as opposed to also the. What's it called? I think it's called DSN, the defense.
Actually, that's part of it, too.
That's DSN is part of Autobahn?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, now, if, as the caller says, there's an 800 number to call to tap into Autobahn, what's the point of having different networks if they're reachable on the same network?
Well, I would assume for an emergency, if it's available from the outside.
Yeah, it's like you dial the 800 number from any phone, and then you dial the prefix and then the code. But what the thing is, you could dial anywhere in the country, or actually anywhere in the world.
Well, who bills for these things? Are there bills generated?
I guess internally. I know where I work. We don't get any. Well, they do bill locally because they have different lines. They have like an A line, a B line.
But who is it that's billing you?
They bill themselves. In other words,
the Department of Defense bills itself.
Right. In other words, like if you have an A line allows you to dial anywhere from your phone on the base. You have like there's like eight is Autobahn, seven is long distance, and nine is local.
Uh-huh.
You can dial out, you can dial anywhere in the world like that. And then they count, they have counting for all that. So they would get a supervisor. supervisor will look over that and say, hey, this guy's dialing Hawaii.
What happens if you dial 8 and then 0 for operator? What do you get?
An operator. It's like an Autobahn operator.
You get the Autobahn operator.
You can ask him. You can say, well, I want the Autobahn prefix for
for Fort George Meade, Maryland,
Harbor.
Let's say.
I want the Autobahn prefix for Pearl Harbor military installation.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that prefix.
And this goes around the world, right? Not just around the country.
All around the world.
Interesting. Well, listen, I'd like to talk about this a lot more, but we're out of time. But feel free to send us any information you have on this.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Anyone out there has access to Autobahn, and we'd sure like to know more about it, because that's one topic that has been misrepresented, I think, more times in the hacker world than almost any other. That's our show for tonight. Fiber Optic, Walter, thanks for stopping by, and we'll see you again next week, same time. And this is Emmanuel Goldstein saying good night. Stay on your phone and learn things. Stay tuned for the WBAI Evening News coming up next here on WBAI New York. Good night.
Now I can't make a call. I couldn't get much worse. But if they could, they would. Don't really bomb for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. One didn't know.
Good evening. In the news tonight, an explosion rips through a New York City subway train, injuring more than 30 people, some critically. And it's official, parts of Harlem, Washington Heights, and the Bronx are to get millions of federal dollars as empowerment zones. And at a time when many states are building more prisons, a number of wardens say bigger and better prisons are not the answer. With these and other stories, I'm Jose Santiago in New York with Verna Avery Brown in Washington, and this is the news for Wednesday, December 21, 1994. And we'll be going to Verna Avery Brown in Washington in a few minutes, but first, our top story this evening, the explosion in the New York City subway system. Officials say an incendiary device blew up, possibly in the lap of a man riding the Brooklyn-bound number 4 train this afternoon, moments after it pulled into the Fulton Street station, not far from the World Trade Center. Authorities say more than 30 people were injured, four of them critically, including the man believed to have been carrying the incendiary device. Witnesses describe a frightening scene with flames and smoke bursting through the subway car and riders in some cases stampeding over each other to escape. Police Commissioner William Bratton says investigators are waiting to interview one of the four injured people who is now in the burn unit at the Cornell Medical Center. He is described as a white male who Bratton says was picked up at a Brooklyn subway station sometime after the explosion and who had suffered burns over much of his body. That man appears to be the prime suspect as the person who might have been carrying the incendiary device. Late this afternoon, a number of city officials, including the mayor, Commissioner Bratton, and Chief of Transit Police Michael O'Connor, held a news conference at City Hall where they described the events surrounding today's subway explosion. Here is a segment of that news conference beginning with Mayor Rudolph Giuliani.
At approximately 1:45 p.m., there was an explosion on the southbound number 4 train at the what would be described as the Fulton Street station. It appears that what has been called an IID, an improvised incendiary device, exploded. The emergency response was immediate by both the police, EMS, fire. The immediate response and the professionalism of it contained a potentially much more damaging situation that could have led to even greater tragedy. The Commissioner, Chief O'Connor, and I visited the scene a short while ago, and there is no structural damage. There was a good deal of damage, but no structural damage. Tragically, 31 people were injured, at least, and that number may change as we continue to investigate the incident. Four are critical and are at the Cornell Burn Center, one woman and three men. Transit Police Officer Otto, who's here with us, was on the train. He's from District 30. He happened to be going to his choir to sing tonight, and he was very, very instrumental in assisting the people who were injured and people who were burned and, in fact, were on fire. And without him, again, it may have been a much more serious situation, and he's to be commended for his immediate and brave response to this incident. All of the packages and briefcases and other things that were left behind on the train, which were the subject of some concern that they might contain another device, have now been searched. There was no other device found, so at least that aspect of it has been cleared at this point. The case is under investigation. I want to caution everyone, as we always do in a situation like this, that facts change because as more and more people are interviewed, numbers tend to change, some of the observations tend to change as you learn more about it. And I want to emphasize that everyone in the city should remain very calm. The emergency response here was close to miraculous in terms of being able to get there on time. The investigation is very much under the control of the New York City Transit Police and the New York City Police Department, and the sense that there was any other device or that it's connected to something else, at least at this point, there's no cause for alarm. And Alan Keeper and the chief will describe to you the resumption of service on the train, but I think that will happen pretty quickly. So let me ask the commissioner to bring you up to date, and then Chief O'Connor.
Okay. At this juncture, based on the preliminary investigation by our forensics and explosives people at the train and on the platform, it would appear that the device involved in this explosion is what is described as an improvised incendiary device, IID, as opposed to an improvised explosive device. Difference being the incendiary device would cause a flame, and an explosive device would be much more severe physical damage or explosion. So we have a device that apparently was ignited for some reason on the train after it had stopped in the station and the doors had opened. The damage to the train is, as you would expect from a flame, seared, smoke, charred. There was not physical damage in the sense of blown out windows or twisted metal, a device that gives off flame. It is at this time believed that the device may have consisted of a what is described as some type of glass jar filled with some type of flammable liquid with an external igniter. And that is a very basic type of device. That's information that we have at this juncture. As the mayor has indicated, we have done a thorough search of that train, of that station. There were many items left behind as people fled the scene in confusion. We have checked all of those and have found no additional devices. We will be working very closely with the transit police. There is, fortunately, as of this juncture, been no deaths caused by this incident. The primary jurisdiction for the investigation will rest with the transit police, with assistance from the New York City police and particularly our explosives people. If a death had occurred, or if one does occur, the city police would assume primary responsibility. So the investigation is continuing. We have a pretty good idea now what occurred. A singular device, a singular event. And with that, I'll ask Chief O'Connor to comment on their particulars and then on to the issue of the service resumption. Mike?
I think all involved ought to be commended with the speed of the response and the evacuation of the people who are injured as a result of this occurrence. And I think one of the things that we see with this is that people help each other when the need is there. The in fact, the incident occurs about 1:45 in the afternoon. It's on a southbound number 4 train, as described. Officer Serrato, who was there within the same car when the explosion occurs, managed to put out some of the clothing that was on fire, the people who were on fire at the time. And EMS, fire department, police department personnel, along with transit authority personnel, respond very quickly. While there is the existing possibility of a secondary device being within the train, people are evacuated and moved out very quickly. The service on the A line and other lines was halted at that point, and Alan Keeper is here to describe the remediation of the problems as it relates to the service on the system. Alan?
I'd like to add my thanks to all of the emergency services for their prompt response. There was excellent cooperation. Officer Otto is due special thanks for his prompt response. He went to the token booth, got in the fire extinguisher, extinguished the flames, and responded in an excellent fashion. We're in the process of restoring service. All service is now bypassing this station complex, but we expect to have the station back in service fully in the early evening. We first will have to get a release on the train involved from the police. Once that's done, it will take us about 2 hours to get normal service restored. There does not appear to be any damage to either the station or our facilities.